The evolution of special tactics in the United States is a complicated story whose roots lie in the violent social and political environment of the late 1960s. Highly unusual and televised events like the Texas Tower Sniper in 1966 and the Munich Massacre in 1972 created the need to develop specialized units to respond to events that were beyond the capabilities of normal patrol officers. While Southern California often receives most of the credit for the development of special tactics because of the efforts of LAPD D Platoon and LASD SEB, it's important to understand that the West Coast was not the only one who were looking at special tactics. In fact, by the early 1980s, there were numerous regions who were all following parallel paths of development, albeit in different stages. In these regions, tactical associations began to form that were focused on sharing information and training among agencies. One of these was the Texas Tactical Police Officers Association, or TTPOA, which was formed in 1984 and this year is celebrating its 40th anniversary. As such, it seemed like a perfect time for us to do an episode on the history and evolution of SWAT in Texas, as well as the history and impact of the TTPOA. My guests today are three influential figures in TTPOA. Lieutenant Dan Colasanto is the current president of TTPOA. Dan is a 30-year veteran of the Garland Police Department, with 28 of those years spent on the SWAT team. Dan has worked in patrol, narcotics, and SWAT, and is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and an Army veteran. In February of 2021, Dan earned a master's degree in Homeland Security with a concentration on counterterrorism from the American Military University. Dan was a SWAT team leader during the May 3rd, 2015 ISIS-inspired terrorist attack in Garland, Texas. Dan also serves on the Intelligence and Terrorism Chair for the NTOA. Paul Ford has experience spanning both the government and private sectors. Paul's diverse roles include being a police officer, instructor, writer, publisher, developer of police training, and sales and marketing executive. Paul began his law enforcement career in 1985. Assuming roles in patrol, SWAT, and as a detective. Paul spent almost a decade on the Austin, Texas SWAT team, serving as the unit's training coordinator and team leader. He is a recipient of more than 60 commendations, including three for meritorious conduct, and in the 1990s, Paul played a pivotal role in reshaping and expanding TTPOA, where he served as a secretary, vice president, and editor of Command magazine. His dedication earned him the association's prestigious Excellent Award in 1999, and in 2001, Paul transitioned to the private sector, where he has held positions at Defense Technology and is currently the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for CSI, known through their brands CTS and Penn Arms. Sandy Wall is a true legend in Texas tactical community. Sandy spent 28 years with the Houston, Texas Police Department, 22 of which were on Houston SWAT. Sandy is a recipient of the TTPOA Excellence Award and the TTPOA Lifetime Achievement Award and the National Police Association's Top Cop for the state of Texas. He has also received the Houston Police Department Chief's Commendation for Valor and the Officer of the Year Award. Sandy has served three times as the president of TTPOA. He's also written two books, invented the wallbanger system, and has taught and testified as an expert all over the United States. This is a really enlightening discussion, and I hope that you enjoy our conversation about TTPOA.
My name is John Becker. For the past four decades, I've dedicated my life to protecting tactical operators. During this time, I've worked with many of the world's top law enforcement and military units. As a result, I've had the privilege of working with the amazing leaders who take teams into the world's most dangerous situations. The goal of this podcast is to share their stories in hopes of making us all better leaders, better thinkers, and better people. Welcome to the debrief.
Guys, thanks so much for being here today. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I set the environment in the intro, but, you know, 66, Charles Whitman climbs the tower at the University of Texas and we, you know, starts the active shooter craze. 72, we have the you know, the Munich massacre at the Olympic Games. And it kind of sets an environment where special tactics teams start developing all over the world. In Texas, Houston SWAT formed in 74, if I'm remembering correctly, Sandy?
That's correct.
Kind of set the early environment for me. What was that like? Because a lot of you guys got there pretty early. What was it like as this is evolving?
Well, I had the luxury of knowing several of the original team members. In fact, we have an alumni association. And February 10th, we will bring all of the surviving members of the original 1974 team together, and it's going to be a big deal. We're going to celebrate those guys. But having talked to many of them, they were handpicked throughout the city. The city force at that time, there's probably about 1,500, 2,000 officers in Houston. And they were handpicked for their talents. Most of them were Vietnam veterans. And it was just a mindset that those guys were used to combat and bad situations, and they would handle it better. They put them all on an airplane and sent them to Quantico to train with the FBI. And when they came back, there was 24 people picked. And that manpower level stayed the same for years and years and years. In fact, it's not much more even now. We have a relatively small team. But those guys said when they got off the plane and made it back downtown to the police station, there were 24 police cars unmarked waiting for them, brand spanking new. And they handed them keys. And it was like a super proud moment that they had a take-on car. And but having said that, the city was all in on it. But they had to buy their own uniforms. Their weapons were bought by the city, but they had to buy their own boots and, you know, ancillary things that kind of come with it, the individual equipment. And they made some horrific mistakes right at first, but the city stuck with them. I think they burned down at least three houses in the first 2 years. The most horrific event, we had an officer that was shot by three escaped convicts that were holed up in an apartment over on the east side of downtown. And a patrol officer tried to make the initial approach on him, and they shot and killed him. And his body was laying in the front yard. And SWAT got there, and they started receiving fire. And the decision was made to use gas on him. And they, back in those days, they didn't know the difference between hot gas, meaning like riot grenades, and indoor gas. So they threw outdoor gas inside a structure and burned it to the ground. They brought it to a resolution, but the city ended up having to buy that apartment building. And but it slowly evolved. Those guys learned quickly. And by the time I came on the SWAT team in 1979, it had only been in place 4 years. But those guys were so squared away and had learned so much. And the things they taught me were state of the art at that time. And just a credit to their ability to adapt, adjust, learn from their mistakes, and improve. And as a result, the team continued to grow.
So when you come on at 79, how many teams do you think there are in the state of Texas?
How many SWAT teams?
Yeah.
You know, I think Dallas was just getting formed. They were probably came on at 74, but at a different level. I don't think they had gotten to the position that they were at now. I would guess maybe two or three. Houston may have been the only full-time, and that's what we were. When you say a full-time SWAT team, a lot of people think, well, you're dedicated to SWAT, but you do other things. You have ancillary duties. We did. I mean, when you went to work, the first 2 hours were working out, and the rest of your time on that shift was training. We didn't have ancillary duties, unless the president came into town or there was some special event. But that's all we did, whereas a lot of teams, they would call themselves full-time SWAT, but they had to do patrol, they had to do warrant execution, they had to do different other things. And that was one of the things that was, a benefit to us in terms of doing just one job. But as a double-edged sword, if you screwed it up, we really didn't have many excuses because the city was giving us what we asked for.
Yeah, I think at that point, so that's, you guys are formed in 74, Deep Platoon is formed in 71. There are probably less than a dozen full-time SWAT teams in the United States in the early 70s, because even agencies that were forming teams were forming counterinsurgency teams or riot teams that also did SWAT stuff. So I think, yeah, you guys were definitely one of the earlier teams, especially earlier teams to go full time. So that's, you get on the team in 79. So NTOA is formed in 1983. TTPOA was formed in 1984. Give me the environment, you know, as TTPOA is formed. Talk to me about that early, those early days.
Well, I actually didn't have much personal involvement in TTPOA when this first storm formed. I got to give credit to some Dallas guys that kind of got that initiative. And they came to Houston and asked if we wanted to be part of it. Another guy on our team, a guy by the name of Paul Day, represented us and helped, I guess, you know, carve out some bylaws and some rules that the organization would operate from. But it was one of those things that wasn't truly supported by their departments. So they had to do it in their off time and weekends. And it was just really, really difficult for guys that are carrying out a full-time job, maybe raising a family, maybe working extra jobs to make ends meet. And then now they're having to devote time to this fledgling organization that's trying to get started. So it really didn't go very far until a guy by the name of Paul Ford got involved. And he had the vision and the foresight and the leadership to see what this organization could be. And so that was a few years later. And then that's where it really took off. So for those first few years, it was just kind of bouncing around. It's kind of a neat idea, a neat concept, but wasn't a whole lot of people fully on board.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it took several years for NTOA to even really take a foothold, even though John, you know, and Mike had really leaned into it. It took them a few years to actually get it off the ground and really start doing training and some of that. So, Paul, you get to Austin SWAT 1989, my memory serves me correctly.
89. Mm-hmm.
So how long is it before you are involved in TTPOA?
It's probably 2 or 3 years. I mean, I'd heard about TTPOA. There was a guy on the Austin SWAT team who had taken the initiative. You remember him, Sandy. His name was Dale Toller. And I think Dale was like a regional director or a training coordinator. So one of our guys was involved. I think I went to the first TTPOA conference in 1992. I met Tom Shelton, who was the president at the time. He was editing the magazine at the time. And from there, I just, you know, steadily got more involved, you know, submitted some articles for the command that Tom was publishing at the time. Started going to the conferences. And at the same time, I had gone to an NTOA conference around 92, 93. I went to an NTOA conference in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And all the greats were there. I mean, John Coleman was there. Sid Hale was there. Ron McCarthy was there. I could go on and on. It was like a moment where I was able, I could make a comparison between what I saw in the TTPOA and what I saw in the NTOA. And both in, like, not just the organizations, but the people. I mean, the caliber, the presence, the quantity and the quality of the information that these guys were sharing. It was a stark comparison to me of, okay, this is the TTPOA and this is the NTOA, and kind of where we needed to be going, you know, what the ground that we needed to make up and catch up, because I was, you know, I'm from Texas. I'm proud to be from Texas, and I was proud to be associated with the TTPOA at the time, but it was a big difference.
Yeah, I think people forget that, you know, in 1984, the Olympics came to California. They came to Los Angeles. And, you know, if the Munich Massacre is the catalytic event that drives the development of special tactics teams, the 84 Olympics is the gasoline on the fire. Between LA Sheriff's SEB, LAPD D Platoon, and FBI, specifically HRT and the LA office, there is a massive amount of money that gets poured onto special tactics in Southern California. You saw this very rapid evolution of tactics and skills, and you know, you had those teams spending a lot of time with the European counterterrorism team, 22SAS, and newly formed GSG-9. And I think that for a while there, the West Coast got this kind of acceleration as a result of the 84 games that didn't happen, you know, in other parts of the country. But with the advent of NTOA, I think you started to see that seeding the other regions, which is kind of exactly what you just described.
Yeah, I was also able to make the connection then that, you know, about tactical community. TTPOA existed, but we really hadn't come together yet as a tactical community. And I felt like I started paying attention. I could see what was going on in California. I could see what was going on in Florida. And Florida teams also seemed to be very advanced. They seemed to be strict about their standards, about PT, about selection process and things like that across the board. The thing that California and Florida had in common were strong associations, a tactical community that grew from those associations. And from there, it seemed that for me that, you know, for Texas to rise, you know, for the Texas boat to rise, that that we needed to have a good tactical community as well. And we had the vehicle, we had the TTPOA, you know, we had the framework for it. It just hadn't all coalesced and come together yet.
Yeah, I mean, just for the historical context, 91, we had the Luby's Diner massacre with 23 people killed and 27 injured in Texas. Lubbock, if I remember correctly.
Killeen.
Which then kind of creates a little more impetus. And then 93, we have the Waco siege, which obviously creates all kinds of attention, both good and bad. Special tactics in you know, worldwide, but also in Texas, even though it wasn't a Texas op, it was an FBI op, it certainly put the focus of the tactical community in that part of Texas. Sandy, when does Paul first lure you into involvement with TTPOA?
I remember like it was yesterday. It was 1995. We were down in Arlington, Texas. At the time, the SWAT athletic competition, what we call it, back then they were called the Police Olympics. I think they're still in an organization, but they ran that. TTPOA didn't have anything to do with it. And we went down there and competed. I know Austin was there. Dallas was there. A lot of the major teams in Texas. And after the competition was over, the next year it was going to be held in Houston. And I had already met with a representative of the Police Athletic Federation and showed them, you know, what we could do for them. And so I had a nutshell of how it was going to run. So they asked me to step up in front of the group and tell them about where this is going to be next year, what it's going to be like. So I did. And after it was over with, Paul comes walking up to me and he said, "Hey, we need to talk." And that's where I got the spiel. And he was basically saying, "Look, I can run the organization, but I need somebody to be the president. I'll handle the magazine, I'll handle the money, but I need somebody to grab this thing by the horns and run with it." And I'm looking at him like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And over about four or five Jack and Cokes, somehow he convinced me to do it. And so I wasn't elected yet. I had to go to the following meeting, which Paul hosted there in Austin, and we had our winter conference, which at the time was the only thing we did. And it was just mainly a few lectures, and I think maybe they had one class offsite. That was about it. It was probably not more than 70, 80 people there, SWAT officers. And we had the election right there, and they elected me. They said, you know, Paul said, "Sandy's going to run," and everybody, yeah, he's in. At least the ones that were still sober voted for me. And then they hand me this shoebox with some papers. And of course, I soon realized the organization is invalid. I wasn't even elected by the bylaws the way they're written. I was supposed to be elected. We had lost our incorporation status with the state of Texas. We didn't have a 501c3. They were telling me we couldn't do that, which I found out later we could, and we did. But we were broke. And I'm looking at Paul like, what the hell did you get me into? And so that's the rest is history.
Okay, so yeah, the truth was, Sandy, that there wasn't any money to handle. We didn't have any. And handling the membership did consist of that shoebox that you got and all those pieces of paper with people that probably hadn't paid dues in 2 years and couldn't figure out, you know, who was an active member or not. So we had the foundation for a tactical community, but we hadn't really organized it yet, John.
We had to pass the hat at the meeting or at the conference in order to pay the hotel bill so that Paul didn't have to go to jail.
Yeah, so there are moments in TTPOA lore that even in California I hear about. The passing of the hat in the basement of the Ramada Inn is one of those moments. Paul, do you want to try to defend yourself there or just go ahead and admit to it now?
No, we had to have that conference to kind of just break even to pay for a magazine and to pay for what we spent at that conference. We had to have that conference, the registrations. And, you know, I tell you, Sandy, at the beginning, the magazine was a big expense for the association. Maybe today magazines are not as big a deal, or having a newsletter isn't as big a deal for a tactical association, I think, as it was back then. But back then it was kind of the standard. If you're going to be a tactical association, you're going to have a publication. You know, Florida SWAT Association had a magazine. NTOA, of course, had Tactical Edge. When Cato formed in California, one of the first things Ken Hubbs did was to have a publication to go along with it. And it was the way that we communicated. It was our platform for communicating and informing, but it was also the suck of money that came out of the association every quarter.
I would agree with that. And I would say it was the face of the organization that gave us some credibility. And I can remember going into corporations around Houston trying to, you know, get some money. And the first thing I'd do was slap that magazine down in front of a CEO or somebody. And he'd look at it. And it was very professionally done, at least by the standards at the time. And he thought, wow, these guys, they got their own magazine. You know, they got officers. They do training around the state. Wow, they have their stuff together. Little did he know, we were sliding by the seat of our pants. In fact, I can remember Paul telling me, Sandy, we need to do a class and get some revenue. I cannot afford to publish the next magazine until we do. And then now we're scrambling trying to put together a class.
Yeah, I think that is a recurring theme among all the associations. You know, it's easy in a modern information environment to forget that in, you know, 1990, 92, 93, 94, there was no internet. There was no, you know, you just go find an article. The way that information was shared in the tactical community was through DTPOA's magazine, Florida SWAT's magazine, and NTOA's magazine. And, you know, the number of people that belonged to multiple associations just so they could read the magazine was a pretty high number.
Yeah. It's funny you should mention the internet. I told a funny story when we were all waiting to come online. There was this new thing called the internet, and I could see these websites popping up, and I didn't know anything about how to do them. So my point man that was on my team, and of course, all the guys on my team, I just basically directed them. You're going to do this and you're going to do this. And so I made John our treasurer at the time to take some of the load off Paul. And then I also said, he was kind of a techie guy. And I said, you're going to put together a website for us. And so he took me over to a webmaster and we sat there for like 2 hours in his office and they're talking French. I don't understand any of it. We leave there. And I said, John, do you know what to do? And he said, no, but I'll figure it out. And the next morning he came into the SWAT office and he looked like crap. I said, what the hell happened to you, John? He said, I've been up all night building this a website. And I said, do we have one? And he said, come here. And we went over to our little computer that I had borrowed from a little company called Compact Computer back at the time that was started in Houston. I had to take the CEO's son out and let him shoot a machine gun to get the computer. But we got it and we powered that thing up and I'll be damned, we had a website. And I wanted to kiss him right on the mouth. I didn't, but I wanted to.
I'm going to need a witness. So, all right. So that's like 90, what are we at, 97, 96, 97?
I think we're 95. Yeah. Well, I think when Sandy and I started talking was 94. And by the time things started coming together and we started actually putting out a magazine and talking about the next competition and a conference in Austin was 95.
So when is the first big TTPOA conference?
Austin, Texas. Tell them about it, Paul.
Yeah, so we had gone to, and this is the part where SWAT guys are competitive. And either if you're on the same team together or you're on different teams in the same association, you're competitive. And we had gone to, I believe, College Station up there near Texas A&M and had our conference. We went up there. It was a good conference, but it was a small conference. And we were four or five of us on the way back, and we just got to talking in the car, and a guy named Kevin Yates, so it's on the Austin SWAT team, said we're gonna make all those guys look like, you know, second place next year. We're gonna have the best conference that this association's ever had, and we're gonna raise the bar. And that's what we set out to do. I told Kevin, you know, when he signed that contract at the hotel, you know, to commit to all the things we committed to, that I was again terrified that, you know, we wouldn't be able to pay for it, but we did. And we ended up having a huge conference, and we had great instructors and huge attendance, and it was fun. We did fun stuff. It was a pivotal moment, I think, for TTPOA, that 98 conference in Austin.
To add some numbers to that, John, a big conference before that was about 120, 130 people. Anytime you went over 100, you were doing good. If you got to 120, 130, that's excellent. Paul went over 400. That was like a phantom leap. You know, we just couldn't believe it.
So that is when TTPOA makes its quantum leap and becomes, you know, one of the biggest conferences in the world at that point. Yep. I mean, yep. 400.
That was huge.
The number. Yeah. So that's 98,
I believe it is. And in 99, we had it in Houston. Of course, Paul's talking about the competition. I'm getting with my guys and we said, we're going to do this even bigger and better. We're going to go over 500. And we did. We went out to Clear Lake and we had it at the Hilton out there right on Galveston Bay. And we went over 500. And then it went to Dallas. And, of course, Mike Finley's involved by them. And he's like, we're going to beat Austin and Houston. And we're going to make this even better. And I think he went to 600. It was just as it rotated around, every city wanted to do it bigger and better than the city before. Just because of who we are and you know, that we're always wanting to beat the next guy.
Well, I think it speaks to the culture of TTPOA. And that still exists, right? There still is this, you know, although it is an association, there's an internal healthy cultural competition that is constantly going on, even among the regions in Texas.
Dan could probably speak to that.
Yeah, so at the winter board meeting, we have, you know, the different regions, and there's a huge competition as far, and I mean, they won't say it out loud, but they're always, I know there was. When I was the region director in Region 7, I was always in competition with the region director of Region 2 in Houston. And we'd go back and forth. I remember one meeting, I think it was Hugo was the region director and down there. And he went first and he's like, yeah, I made, you know, whatever amount of money he made. And I went, man, I said, I've made so much money. I don't even know how much, but I know it was more than Hugo. And I made it to be like a penny more, and he got mad. He was super competitive, but there is that competition among the regions as to who's bringing in more money and that sort of thing.
And of course, all that money's from classes. Those guys got to go out and work and make those classes.
Yeah, no, they're working. That's not as I like to say, everybody thinks the SWAT fairy comes down and waves her magic wand and these classes happen. There's a lot of work that goes into not just getting the instructor, finding a place to do the class, and then putting on the class, making sure it's run safely and everything gets done. And then comes the real hard part, which is taking care of the rosters, making sure the guys are getting the TCO credit, making sure everything is right for the record keeping, and that sort of thing. And that's it's an administratively heavy load.
So I'm hearing you say that, Dan. It sounds like you're no longer using Paul's shoebox strategy.
No, we're a little bit more advanced than the shoebox at this point.
All right. You know, it's, you know, some traditions just have to die, I guess.
We always hoped it would get there, Dan.
it's there. Trust me.
Sandy, before we move on kind of more modern era TTPOA, I want to go back and just kind of early evolution of special tactics in Texas. You know, you and I have talked in the past about things that were drivers, and one of those was the relationship between Houston and the Tier 1 teams. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say before we really started developing that expertise with those guys, we were pretty much a surround and negotiate, you know, call out, gas them out. We would call ourselves a hostage rescue, but I can't think of any that we, if we did it, we didn't do it very well, because we didn't know what we were doing. And we didn't have, I didn't know anybody in San Antonio or anybody in Austin or anybody in Dallas. So we just didn't have other expertise that to call on. So we're figuring this out as we go. And I call it inbred training. We're learning from the guys that were here before me. They're just passing it down, the mistakes, and we're trying to get better at it. But somewhere along the line, and I my memory escapes who actually, if they reached out to us or we reached out to them. But at the time, the economy was not that good, and we had a lot of older buildings in Houston that were going to be torn down or needed to be torn down. And somehow these guys from Fort Bragg, everybody knows who I'm talking about, came down and said, we'd like to develop a relationship with you guys, and if you'll go out and show us these buildings, introduce us to the owners, and we'll negotiate the deal. We'll bring people down here. We'll train. You can train with us. In fact, when the deal's over, you can send a team up to Fort Bragg, and we'll train with you up there. And, you know, I grew up in the Vietnam era, and I just wasn't a real big, I guess, not that I didn't like the military. I wanted to join the Army. But after Vietnam, I had just sour taste in my mouth, and I was thinking, you know, what really can these guys do? And then the first time I went out with them and I went, oh, my God, they were showing us stuff that I hadn't even imagined. And they were showing us how we really should be training and operating. And, of course, the force multiplier with that is we're spreading them to the teams around us. After these guys would get on their C-140 and fly back to Fort Bragg, we're taking all this knowledge that we learned. We're spreading it around to other guys, and everyone is getting better. And then, of course, it wasn't long. We got involved with TTPOA. And not only are we sharing what we knew, but we're bringing in guys that had now retired from that unit. And they're kind of got their own shingle hanging up. And they're, a gun for hire now. And they're going around and teaching what they were teaching the operators at Fort Bragg. They're teaching the law enforcement now. And we're bringing them in. And it's just, I can't imagine. And nothing to take away from the SEALs, because the SEALs came to. We learned from them as well. We just had more of a relationship with the Bragg guys, but both of them, Tier 1 operators, we learned so much. And I'm telling you, they probably saved lives, not only the hostages, but ours, because we would have screwed it up trying to, you know, be what we eventually became.
Yeah. It's interesting because you see the same thing in the West Coast. You see the same thing in Florida, where, you know, the Tier 1 teams develop out of Munich and on the heels of Munich, and, you know, 84 Olympics happens. Everybody's engaging with the SEAL teams. They're engaging with the guys in Bragg. And you just see this kind of catalytic effect of law enforcement working with military units, and military units coming to law enforcement to learn about urban environments. Law enforcement's going to military to learn about tactics. And it just creates this kind of synergistic relationship that I think makes everybody better in a hurry.
Yeah, I would add to that. I recently wrote a book, based on my career, but a large portion of it is my SWAT career. And in the book, I tell a lot of stories of our interaction with those guys. And almost every story ends with the title, "These guys are crazy." Because, I mean, the things the safety limits that they were willing to push, even in training, we would like, really? Are we really going to do that? Like, yeah. I can remember once they crashed a little bird, and it was at night. They crashed it, and they had two operators on either side. The little bird flipped on its side, had two operators pinned. underneath it. We're running over there trying to get this helicopter off these guys to get it. The other two jumped off and hit the target. And while we're over there trying to save these guys' lives underneath the little bird, these guys are hitting the target. And when they came back, I'm like, what the hell have you guys been? They said, well, we hit the target. I said, the helicopter crashed. And he said, well, that's what we'd have done in a real deal. And then I look at them and I realize these are guys at a level that I can't even imagine. I mean, we would have called a real world event, stopped everything and focused, not them. If that's what they were doing a real deal, that's what they did. And I mean, it was a mindset that I don't think I know I could never get to. And they were at a level I could never get to. But oh my God, did we learn from those guys?
I think another catalyst for development, explosive entry starts largely in Texas. I mean, it happens in a variety of places, but it develops pretty quickly in Texas. And I think that's because of your relationship with Alan Brosnan, right?
Yep. Paul, you can probably speak to that.
Yeah, Alan was one of the early supporters of the association. He would come, he would pay money and advertise in our publications. He would submit articles. He came to our conferences for free, and he would provide this training. And, he was a close friend and a strong ally of the TTPOA all through those 90s as we were developing. And I think, by and large, Alan has done the same thing all over the country. Sandy, Dan knows him. He's a interesting person and a very unselfish person. And he was also he fits in that he wants to help you. He wants, you to rise, to another level. Just like the tactical communities in California and Florida were helping Texas to rise up in the 90s, Alan was the same way. And it was just a great relationship.
Yeah, I think there were a handful of people that kind of nationally were populating knowledge, Alan Brosnan from Tees being one of those. Sandy, who or Paul, who were the early movers? I've heard you refer to the Fab Five, Houston, Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and Abilene. Did I get that right?
Yep. Yeah. You had Mike Finley. We brought him on a little bit later, but Mike hit the ground running and took off and did great things for the association. Shannon Couch was in it from the very beginning. He was there before me or Paul, although, being from Abilene, a smaller town and kind of out in West Texas, he was limited, but that guy was always there. He was always a hard worker, and somehow if he said he was going to do it, he did it. And then you get over to San Antonio, you got a guy named George J. Hant, several other guys, Eddie Moe, the list goes on and on, but they were not as active in the association back then in terms of like being a regional director or a board member. But when we needed them to host a class or to host a conference, they stepped up and they did their part. So, yeah, those are the names that come to mind for me. Paul, can you add?
No, I would just say that, number one, it was Shannon Couch and Abilene, Mike Finley, yourself and myself. But we had departments that supported us. Our commanders and our rank structure in our departments, they were behind us. They let us, take city time to do TTPOA business sometimes. And we had teammates who were like, okay, you're the guy of the TTPOA, but we're your team. So we always had guys within our unit that were pitching in and kind of forming a cell around us to help out. We definitely couldn't have done all the things we did, just the four of us. I think it's those four guys that were kind of, making the call to action in those first three or four years. I mean, we were really having to like, hey, join the TTPOA, do something, host a class, send an article in for the Command magazine, This stuff isn't free, you know. it costs money to run this association, you know. So those four guys were the ones making the call to action. But as the herd kind of grew, we started kind of snowballing and got a lot of momentum.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, TTPOA is bringing in, you know, national level experts, you know, Sid Hale and Ron McCarthy and, the guys that are kind of leading the charge nationally. You are pulling them in, and then it's not long after that that you are becoming the national experts, right? And Sandy Wall is teaching all over the United States and testifying all over the United States. Within a period of about 10 years there was a massive transition from a fledgling organization to one of the strongest associations in the country.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then, you know, we relied a lot on the NTOA right at first to bring us talent like the Ron McCarthy's and the Sid Hills and those guys that came down. And then we started branching out into the tier one groups and the black ops guys that were coming in. And then we started developing our own cadre. And, we relied a lot on Paul Howe for a while, and he had already retired from the Army and helped us out a lot. But now the association, although they still bring in those world-class guys and those guys with those experience that, you know, only a person that has been over in a hostile environment and had to fight your way in, do the job, fight your way out, and they're going up against trained soldiers instead of idiots like a lot of times we do, but we have a talent base now within the association, and I'm super proud of. And some of the things, I guess, that I'm just as proud of, not only what I did for the association, but I brought in a guy like Paul Hershey, who became a president of the association and took it to the next level, and then a Gary Heath. Those guys were all from Houston. So they were, I guess, learning from me, not because I was doing it right, but what not to do. But then became a leader within the association to take it to the next level. And it's like I've told Dan more than once, because he gives me and Paul a lot of credit. And, you know, I'll take a little bit of it. But we were about building a foundation. And as you guys know, there's no structure that can stand if it's got a crumbling foundation. We built that foundation, but those guys built the tower on top of the foundation, and it's still going up. I mean, every conference I go to, I'm amazed at what they've done with what we started with.
So let's talk about that for a minute. So, Dan, you're the current president of TTPOA. Talk to me about the current TTPOA.
All right. So right now, we're on our third website. had to throw that out there. We're kind of in a transition, getting from the people from the old one has come back. So we're at, pulled some numbers for you that you asked. We're about 2,000, it'd be about 2,000 members right now that we have signed up, that we still have people signing up, because of the new website. As far as the conferences go, I think the biggest one we ever had was 700. Last year we were at about 600 registered, but we had about 1,000 attendees. We've been staying pretty steady at about 1,000 attendees now, between signed up people and people coming to the vendor show. We had about 600 last year. So I know one story they told was vendors. They had like 13 vendors at the first conference. And on TMPA podcast, I told them, I said, yeah, well, and this is true, we had 13 in the lobby because they wouldn't fit in the ballroom. Andy Atkins does a phenomenal job with that. We had about 200. Vendors last year, and we have 97 signed up now, so we're on track to stay around 200 plus. And the vendor show for us drives the train. You're talking about going to different places, we need about 50,000 square feet for a hotel to have the vendor show. And if they don't have that, we have to try to find another spot. So we're kind of you'd be surprised. There's not many places that have that. So
no, it's nationally that it'd be. Yeah, that is a true national level show. I mean, there are shows that regard themselves as national level shows that are not as large as the TTPOA conference. And it is certainly, you know, one of the top two or three in the country consistently.
We had a waiting list last year. We'll probably have a waiting list again this year.
That's fantastic. Talk to me about training. I know TTPOA does a lot of training, both at a kind of regional and an association level. Tell me a little bit about what TTPOA is currently doing training-wise.
So training wise, we have the last I checked, we had about 84 classes for this year. For this year into next year, we had probably we did probably over 150 last year. The regional directors do that. They handle most of the year round training. They're kind of the glue that kind of keeps everything together as far as the training goes. We have a myriad of instructors. You know, one of the things we do as an organization is we our goal, our mantra, if you will, is we provide training. That's our mission. The agencies and the end users decide how they're going to do it. We've been talking about explosive breaching. We offer explosive breaching from all the big three people that do it, from Alan Brosnan, from FET, Mr. Cherry, he does it. And we provide that training. Same thing with tactics. We have Army guys, we have Navy guys, we have officers, we have our own cadre guys that do it. Same thing with shooting. We have world champion shooters and we have our own cadre guys. If you come to this year's conference and you want to shoot and you don't shoot, it's your fault because we have several world champions. We have Ben Stugger, we have Matt Pranka, we have Dan Brokos, we have, I mean, Rob Vogel. I mean, we have all kinds of instructors. During the year, we've had Rob Latham has taught up in Region 7. So we're bringing in all these instructors. So you have your choice. And the good thing about it is the region directors can reach out to their regions and say, hey, I can call up and go, hey, I need a class from Sandy Wall, or I need a class on tactical basket weaving. And we will find the guy or the girl, and we will have that class. So those guys do a good job. They're like I said, they're the kind of the glue that keeps the organization rolling throughout the year. And I think we're one of the only associations that do offsite training like that continuously throughout the year. So those guys stay pretty busy because, like I said, it's not just putting on the class and bringing the instructor. That's the easy part. The hard part is all the admin work that goes along so that these guys get the credit for the training.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, it's that is a full-time training business that is, you know, turning Absolutely. Out thousands of students a year. And
yes.
You know, the idea that it grew from, you know, literally everything is in a shoebox is kind of a staggering concept. And 20
and
years.
The thing that blows my mind is run by volunteers. None of these guys yes. get so, a dime. No, they're all doing it on their own time for the right reason.
And one of our things that we talk about and we talked about it with the NTOA was like some standard stuff. So there's basic SWAT in Texas, the course has to be a minimum of 60 hours, and there's certain topics that have to be covered within the class. You can go over 60 hours, but it has to be a minimum of 60. And some of the class, it's like team composition, SWAT history, legal liability. I think gas is in there too. Some other gas insertion and less lethal. And then you can kind of freelance after that. But there's specific topics, and I may be leaving some out, but there's specific topics that need to be covered. But the one thing we discovered was, and that's for TCOL, there is nothing for advanced SWAT. Now, we've been doing advanced SWAT, and most guys would agree, most of our regions, it's hostage rescue based. So it's hostage rescue topic. So what I tasked our training advisory board with at our winter meeting is, hey, we need to come up with a set of standards for advanced SWAT. Hey, it's got to be 40 hours, and these are the topics that need to be covered, and put that through to TCOL so we get an actual TCOL number for advanced SWAT. So now we can say, look, in Texas, for basic SWAT, you got to have this class, and these are the criteria. For advanced SWAT, you have to have this class, and these are the criteria. Because those are the big two that we do. And a lot of the guys that do those classes are volunteers. They were lucky. The agencies let those guys come on their training time. So, and it's very, for us, we really try hard to make the training inexpensive, as inexpensive as possible.
I think one thing that's kind of unique about TTPOA is, you know, some state associations find themselves in the middle of the political dialogue about yeah. setting standards, about, you know, the way law enforcement interacts with state government. And it does seem to me that you guys have made a conscious choice to stay out of that.
Yes, we have. I'm lucky. I have these guys. They mentioned Gary Heath. Gary Heath's the one who got me. He jumped me in, as they say, at one of the Dallas conferences. So I'm lucky because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. I have these guys to rely on. I call them a lot. Hey, if I'm screwing this up, please call me and tell me that you're doing something stupid. You know, I kind of joke with Gary Heath and call him the special assistant to the president because I've called him many times and go, hey, I'm about to do this. And he goes, maybe you should do this instead. Shannon Couch is on the board. He's our secretary. And so I have him to rely on a lot of times. But none, and I'm going off of what was done before me. And we never got into that. We never got involved in that. And I don't think that's something that, you know, as long as I'm the president, we're not going to get involved in it because our job is training. Our job isn't getting involved in politics. We don't do that. We just don't. I don't think it's a good idea. We have too much other stuff to worry about, getting guys trained and getting some guys, you know, because there's a lot of agencies that can't afford it. We have a tremendous number of guys, you'd be surprised. These, I mean, Sandy and Paul know, they pay their own way. I mean, not everybody's that lucky where their agency pays. I've had guys come to class going, I paid my own way, paid my own hotel, paid for my own ammo. And I got a soft spot in my heart for that. And I'm like, all right, well, we're comping your spot to this class. We'll refund your money because you had to pay this other stuff. So it's very important for me. And the reason guys know, hey, listen, you know, you get a guy like that, comp his spot. Because that's part of our deal as a 501c3. We donate a lot of training. We give free spots out a lot to agencies that, you know, they just don't have the budgets.
Well, I think you touched on something that is an essential role that the associations play, which is, you know, Texas is you know, one of the largest countries in the world. Even though we see it as part of the United States, it may see itself as an independent country. And it's a mixed, it's a mixed bag of large full-time teams and very small part-time teams. And I think an important role the association plays is to bring the lessons learned from the full-time team, from the national level experts down to teams that otherwise might not have that opportunity.
Yeah. And I think we do a really good job of that. The Big Five, they play a major role in instructing for us. And I think one of the other things that I'm proud of is I think if you go across the regions and you go to a basic SWAT, you're going to get the same stuff pretty much. I mean, there's different ways. And you know, what I'm fond of saying is, hey, what we can do in Garland, you know, they may not be able to do down in Laredo. You know, what they do in Houston, we may not be able to do. So some of that stuff also depends on what resources you have. Not everybody has a Bearcat, not everybody has a Rook, not everybody has these tools. So you have to give them other options to still solve. The problems are the same, but you know, we have to give them, our challenge is to give them options to solve these problems, maybe not without the same tools that other teams have, because they still have to get solved. I mean, the barricaded guy is the barricaded guy, no matter where he's at. And it's, you know, I mean, the way to resolve it is probably similar, but you may not have the same tools and resources as others to do that.
And I would say, looking from the outside now, as a, you know, as a person in business, as a non-police officer, but someone still involved with law enforcement, what I see now is, in the 90s, yeah, we were able to get people to have PT tests and have a real selection process to choose your SWAT team. But what you guys have done now seems, the way that teams approach a mission, their tactics and their technology that they apply to it, that's what you guys have got everybody on a one sheet of music in a really big state. You know, a lot of spread out geography and a lot of people, which is quite amazing for me.
Yeah, it's a challenge, but I think, you know, the technology piece is huge. But again, it goes back to not everybody has the same technology. And before I forget, I do want to mention one thing. We talked about the magazine. The magazine's all digital now. We stopped mailing it out, but it's still there. But it's the trend that everybody else is going to. Like Sandy said, you don't find many published magazines from the associations. And ours is
while
all
I was at SHOT Show, I did have somebody put in my hand Cato Field Command, color publication. So not to be competitive with Cato, but I just let you know that.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I think, as you said, it costs money to publish the,
yeah,
to publish the magazine.
Save a tree.
That's right. Trying to save a tree. Trying to put that money somewhere else.
Well, you do raise a valid, interesting point, though. Is, you know, the stronger associations now, Dan, seem to have a higher level of integration than they've had in the past. Like, I know that, you know, you and Brent Stratton from TTPOA and Chris Eklund from Florida SWAT, and like, you guys are talking, you know, Nick Sprague at RMTTA are talking more regularly, kind of at a national level. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I gave props to Nick. He kind of set that up. We had our first, maybe last year, we had our first President Zoom meeting. And we're kind of doing it on a regular basis now. So all the presidents that can make it, we have a Zoom meeting discussing different things as far as, you know, hey, how are you doing vendors? How are you vetting instructors? What do you guys do for the membership? What are your bylaws like? So we're kind of getting on the same page as far as that stuff goes, association wise, which is really good. And it's good to meet with those guys, and they're some of them are starting associations. So, you know, the bigger associations like us and Cato and Florida are trying to help these guys out. Like, hey, this is, you know, this is what I would suggest. You know, what it was, it kind of reminded me of Paul and Sandy's story. The one guy's like, yeah, we're trying to do this. We got this hotel. And, you know, I go, man, I would start with debriefs. Just get some debriefs, get some people over there before you try to expand into the, you know, a larger deal. But, you know, the story is the same. I mean, the way they're starting out, it's the same thing. But I think it's important that we're all meeting and discuss, because the problems are the same. It's just the people are different. They're running into the same things. So, but I think it's, you know, at least as far as tactics and the way things are growing, you know, we can talk that out and figure out, hey, this is what we're doing. What are you guys doing? But again, it goes like my analogy in Texas. You know, what we can do in Texas, they may not be able to do in California or Colorado. And what they do in Colorado, we may not be able to do. So but it's still good to talk that out. And I think the important thing is that we are all together talking about things and the issues that we're each facing and the challenges. Because in a lot of respects, they're the same.
Yeah, no, 100%. And although tactics, you know, although the political will changes geographically, yes, tactics don't, right? Like the challenges, you know, you said a barricade's a barricade. Like, everybody is faced with barricades, and I don't care what state you're in, there are barricades. And so the more teams, you know, and associations sharing information, you say these analogy, you raise our players, Paul's with raising all boats. Everybody is getting better by sharing information. There is not an overabundance of quality information in the environment. So the more you guys are interacting, it seems the better the entire community gets.
I agree 100%.
So Dan, if people want to learn more about TTPOA, how do they find it?
Go to the website, ttpoa.org. If you go up there now, our conference stuff is up there, 40th anniversary. We're hoping to make a big splash for the 40th. So it's up. Everything's up there now. All the information for the conference, ttpoa.org. You can sign up, join up. You don't have to be from Texas. We'll let you come from the outside. We don't even charge you extra for that. So,
I mean, is that true? Even if you're from California, though.
I like Brent. Brent's a good guy. So we kind of made a little agreement. We kind of made a treaty. So it's all good. So we let those guys in. Everything's on the website, brand new website. Thanks to Aaron Marco and those guys. TTPOA.org. All the information about the association is right there.
So Sandy, rumor is that this is the last year that you will be involved or be on the border with TTPOA. Is that the truth?
That's the truth. All things, good things must come to an end. And I recognize that there's other people that can step up and do and offer something new, fresh ideas, fresh energy. And that's a good thing. When I left HPD SWAT, I was probably still a decent operator, but I'd lost a step and I knew that. And I had other things I could be doing that were probably more beneficial in the long run. And it's same thing here. You know, my time has come. I'm just so grateful to the guys for letting me hang around, even after my usefulness was over, but I'm stepping away from the board. I will still always be there, and anything I can do to help the association, I will, because it has paid untold benefits back to me for whatever effort I ever put in.
And I did talk him into being the MC for the banquet. So
one last hurrah, and I'm gone.
One last hurrah, absolutely.
I love it. Well, I feel like an appropriate place for us to wrap up would be to go back to each of you guys. And what do you think, looking back now over the evolution of TTPOA, what do you think people need to know about TTPOA or about the evolution of SWAT in Texas that we haven't covered? Paul, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I think the thing that inspired me and the thing that continues to inspire me, I'm amazed when I go to my own department here in Austin and I see who those guys are, what their capabilities are. Same goes with TTPOA. I'm amazed when I go to the conferences and see what you guys accomplish every year, and you seem to top it. My parting word would be is that it's going to advance. It's going to continue to get better. It's going to, your capabilities are going to continue to increase, but only if we have this kind of community, only if we have this kind of interagency association where people can share, people can learn from each other. It's going to continue to get better and more sophisticated, more technology aided. So, whatever we did for the last 30 years, I don't know, but, it's gotten better. And congratulations to guys like, Dan and Sandy, who've stuck with it and continue to push it uphill.
Dan, you want to take us next?
Yeah, I think, it's a great organization. We're still trying to build. My goal was to obviously make it better than it was when I started. And I have no doubt that the people who come after me will make it better than whatever it is that we're doing right now. But we provide some good training. It's affordable, and we're out there as an asset to these agencies that need help with training. So I think we have nowhere to go but up, hopefully.
Sandy Wall.
Well, I'd like to finish with the way I started talking about the original SWAT team in 1974. Those guys were handpicked and selected and volunteered to do a job that they had no clue. And they got a little bit of training from the get-go, but after that, it was trial and error. And they learned from their own. And they weren't getting any extra pay. They were doing it for the right reason. They didn't have an association to call on. They didn't have outside instructors that were coming around and spreading information and showing expertise. They learned by trial and error. And they passed it on to guys like me. And then I met a guy named Paul Ford who changed my life. And we started trying to build this association who other guys had started. And we took it to another level. And then guys like Dan have taken it to another level. But I will say this, that before I got involved in the association, I didn't know anybody in Austin or San Antonio or Dallas or anywhere, El Paso. And now every city of any size, I've got somebody there that I know. And a lot of them I've met, and if nothing else, sat in a hospitality suite. And we talked about, when y'all do this, how do you do that? Or, oh my God, never do this, because this did not work out well. And you're like, what happened? And then you visualize, God, that could have been me. I need to go back and learn from this. So that's
fostering those relationships, fostering those ideas, and bringing all of those smaller agencies up to a level that they could have never imagined if not for their association or for this association and learning and the exposure that it's given them. So hats off to TTPOA and everything it's done for me, and I just can't say enough. And God bless you, Dan, for still carrying the flag.
Thanks, sir. But hey, you're still going to be advisor to the president, even though you're not going to be on the board, just so you know.
I'm here for you.
Well, guys, thank you. I mean, I hope you realize that the contributions that each of you made not only made officers in Texas, but officers all over the country safer. And, you know, let's hope that, that Dan is going to take this to an entirely different level and the guys that follow him will do the same.
We're going to hope that Dan doesn't screw it up. He's going to try hard not to.
You got it, brother.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. And thanks for being with me.
John, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, John.